All right, welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our 10:30 docket, Clifford versus McCall Grusin. I believe everyone has checked in. If the clerk will please announce counsel who will be presenting today. All right, counsel, Mr. Ogle.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. Keith Ogle on behalf of appellant Richard Clifford. This appeal arises out of a March 4, 2013 judgment following a bench trial, at the conclusion of which Ms. McCall Grusin moved for a motion for judgment. It is Mr. Clifford's contention that that motion should not have been granted, that the judgment is erroneous, and we presented six grounds for appeal. The first being that the evidence is legally and factually insufficient to support the failure to find on the elements of conversion, or alternatively, that the evidence is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence on those elements. Second, that the trial court, because Mr. Clifford did prove all of the elements of conversion conclusively, that the trial court improperly denied him of his remedy of either the right to retrieve his items or to render a judgment for money damages. Third, Mr. Clifford had a claim for breach of an oral lease agreement, which the trial court erroneously denied on the basis of the statute of frauds. Fourth, there is no independent legal ground that's either properly pleaded or properly proved that can support the judgment on some sort of other independent theory. And then the fifth and sixth grounds are essentially that the judgment is erroneous for one of two reasons, either A, because the trial court denied a motion to compel discovery that Mr. Clifford apparently in the trial court's eyes needed to prove his case for conversion. Therefore, his claim and his case was vitiated and severely compromised, in depriving him of the right to put on all of his evidence. Or B, the manner in which the trial court conducted the trial was basically manifestly unjust.
Turning to announcing ready, what did he do to any claim that he still needed discovery?
Well, announcing ready, the only thing that announcing ready did was waive his right to seek a continuance based upon some sort of evidence that he either knew of or should have known of. In this case, he had already asked for this evidence in a interrogatory, and he moved to compel it, which the trial court had already denied. So the trial court had already denied his request for this discovery. So I have not located a case that says in order to preserve your complaint about a denied motion to compel, you then need to not announce, you need to A, move for a continuance, and then B, announce not ready. And the case law about announcing ready just says you just waive, like I said, something you knew about. So if there's a witness that you should have known about and all of a sudden you say, oh, I need to go depose that witness, well, that's when announcing ready hurts you, because you can't then later say, well, now I need this witness. So I don't think that announcing ready harmed Mr. Clifford in the way that Appley contends. On the issue of conversion, it's not, there's four elements. These are not, it's well known to the court. I don't really need to read through them all. Both sides agree on both sets of briefs lay out the elements basically verbatim. And the trial court's judgment said that the elements of conversion were not met. Well, on appeal, in her brief, Ms. McCall Grusin has conceded that elements 2, 3, and 4 were, in fact, all met. So I think that our burden in a bench trial and a motion for judgment is to conclusively establish, as a matter of law, that we prove these elements. And he's conceded that we conclusively proved elements 2, 3, and 4. Ms. McCall concedes that she unlawfully and without authorization took Mr. Clifford's property. The only question in this appeal for this, really what's raised in the briefs, is what property did Ms. McCall take? And
I think the question is, what property was proved? What proof was there,
correct,
of what property was taken?
Correct. Yes.
Yes.
Did Mr. Clifford conclusively establish what property was converted,
right,
of his? Or, in the alternative, did he put on, is the adverse finding against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence relative to the property he contends was converted? And as we've laid out in the brief, the trial court instructed at a pretrial hearing, instructed Mr. Clifford to put on a list of all of the property he contends was converted, which he did. He filed that in the record a year in advance of this trial. And at trial, he handed up to the judge his list, and they had a discussion about, this is the same list that you filed in the clerk's record. Yes, it is. And there was no controverting evidence whatsoever from Ms. McCall Grusin that this was not his property. She didn't take the stand and say, well, these items weren't your property or were my property as appellee. So from a legal sufficiency standpoint, this court is to look at the entire record first to see if there's any evidence to support the adverse finding, i.e. that this is not really his property. And she put on no evidence whatsoever that this is not Mr. Clifford's property. So what this court then does is look at the record to see, did Mr. Clifford conclusively establish that this is his property? And it's our position that this list conclusively establishes everything that was taken in the conversion that she admits she did do.
So your position is that it doesn't matter that he stated he does not any longer know what exact property is in the real estate still.
That's correct, because what I think Ms. McCall Grusin argued, and I think the trial court got I don't want to say misled, but confused about, is it's not what is still there 5 months, a year, or on this appeal, whether what's there, if it's at the property, if it's buried in the backyard, if it's in a trunk, if it's burned, if it's sold, whatever, it was converted on the day she locked him out and refused to let him come back. So that's everything that's converted. And what she's done with it now is wholly irrelevant, except to the extent that he's asking for it back. If it's gone, he obviously can't get it back, and he'd be entitled to damages. If she still has it or has a right to get it, then he could get it back. So where it is only relevant insofar as Mr. Clifford's remedy. But what it is really the question, and that's where the court sort of lost focus. And so when the court keeps asking Mr. Clifford, what's there? You went out and looked at it, didn't you? Can't you tell me what's there? And he was pro se. He was, I would say, unprepared with some of his evidence as far as answering those kind of questions. But that was not something he had to prove. That was putting him to a burden he did not need to meet.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
What was the effect of the eviction proceeding?
The effect of the eviction proceeding?
Yeah, as I understand it, there was an eviction proceeding. He did not appear. The trial judge gave him a certain length of time to get out of the property and to remove all his property. And if he didn't do that, then the property left on the premises would be deemed abandoned and belong to the landlord. Isn't that fundamental landlord-tenant law?
It perhaps is, but there's also fundamental tenant landlord law that if you evict somebody, which you have a lawful right to do, you can't then deny them the right to get the property. So if the default judgment says, get out of the property and take your personal possessions, and you have 7 days to do that.
Right.
If during that 7-day window you then deny the tenant their ability to get their property back.
Is there evidence that during that 7-day window he wasn't allowed?
Yes, Your Honor. The testimony in the trial court is that he had begun to move. It's somewhat unclear as to all of the dates, but there is testimony in the record that he was moving before the default judgment was entered, and that he took some of his property with him, but that this is on page 17 and 18 of the record. He had some health issues that prevented him from recovering all of his property. He had 3 back surgeries. That's in the record. And what happened is she locks him out at some point, and he starts calling.
After the week.
Well, before and during the week. He tested, because the Judge Moore specifically asked, during the week, did you try to get your property back? And Mr. Clifford said, yes, I did. I called, and she wouldn't let me, and she refused to let me. And that's when I went to a lawyer to try to get the default set aside, and then the conversion lawsuit was filed. So as far as the eviction process, I would agree that if there were no evidence in the record that she denied him all of these access to the property during that 7-day window, I would agree with you that the eviction process probably would bar Mr. Clifford's right here. However, because he was effectively denied the right given to him through the default judgment to get his property, she's converted it. And so I don't think that you can – I think that if we're looking at the question of what is the effect of the eviction, I thought that could that be perhaps argued an abandonment? Well, if you look at the clerk's record, page 8, Ms. McCall-Gruson did not plead abandonment. So you can't have a defense support a judgment that's not pleaded. And as far as proof, I think that there's no testimony controverting what Mr. Clifford said as far as this timeline. It is somewhat unclear on exact dates, but it is very clear that he was denied the right to come in. So if we're looking at the question of proof, there's no evidence of an abandonment here, or conversely, he has conclusively established the fact that he was denied this right to get it, so there can't be an abandonment under a legal insufficiency standard. Alternatively, if there's a fact question about abandonment, even though it's not properly pleaded, then that would be something to be remanded for consideration. But this is not an issue that they move for in their motion for judgment. This is not an issue they briefed on appeal. This is not an issue they have ever argued in support of affirmance of this judgment. So I looked for case law to say whose burden is it to come up with every conceivable legal theory, and I couldn't really clearly find that. And so I just took it upon myself to try to do it, just in case it is my burden. I think it should be his burden. I don't know that it's the court's burden to just conceive of every legal theory in the world that would be raised by the pleadings and the proof. Maybe it is. But in any event, I took it upon myself, and we've shown that abandonment cannot support this judgment. Really, if we get down to what Mr. Clifford's remedy is, if assuming that we have conclusively established conversion, or even assuming that we're going back for a remand on conversion, what is his remedy? The motion for judgment said that Mr. Clifford didn't prove damages and didn't elect his remedy. Well, the fact is he did try to elect his remedy. At the very tail end of the trial, he says, "Can I not even retrieve my things?" And the judge says, "Because I don't know what is out there, I can't let you retrieve, quote, your things." So the judge knows these are all Mr. Clifford's things. He just thinks that Mr. Clifford needs to come in with some sort of specificity as far as what is still there. The remedy
Does that sound unreasonable to you?
I think that...
that if you're going to go into a house that is not yours, the record doesn't reflect who lives there, right? As we're speaking today, doesn't reflect who lives there, who else has things there. You don't think there should be some limit on what he can walk out of there with?
Well, I think that the trial court could impose limits in his judgment. When they did the property inspection, the judge ordered in that inspection order that there would be no breach of the peace. And at the time, I believe arrangements were made for a sheriff to be there. I think a judgment could certainly specify those types of constraints. Description of these items. I don't know what's there and what isn't all at the house. So it could prove problematic, but she put on no evidence that there's going to be this mass confusion at the house, or that there's other property. What other property, if any, is at this house?
Well, couldn't the trial judge have entered a judgment which allowed him to collect the items on his list that he submitted to the court to the extent that they are there on those premises?
Yes, and that is...
If a different sofa is sitting there that's not on his list, he can't take it.
Correct. And that's what we think the appropriate judgment the trial court should have rendered is to the extent that there is property that is there that is on his list, he should have been able to retrieve it because that's what he wants. He wants his property back. And alternatively, if there's things that aren't there, if they've been sold on eBay, buried, burned, whatever... I think that the appropriate remedy is damages for those items to make Mr. Clifford whole. So the trial court should have rendered that judgment, and since the trial court did not, we are asking this court, that would be the first judgment that we would ask of this court, is to reverse the trial court's judgment, essentially modify it to award Mr. Clifford the return of all of the items on his list that Ms. McCall-Gruson still has, either at the property or elsewhere, and if she can't come up with it, to then pay the fair market value or the actual value as established in the list. And there's several fallback judgments that we've sort of asked for as far as remanding. If we haven't proved damages, let's go back solely on the issue of damages. If there's a question of this list, if we need something beyond this, I guess we could go back. But I think Mr. Clifford has conclusively established his property that was converted. And so the proper disposition would be to allow him to get that back or damages for things that can't be. We don't think that there's any other supportive independent grounds that can support this. There was no evidence to prove latches, no evidence to prove waiver. I'll rest on my briefing on those points. On the oral lease, the question that was asked wasn't what was this a contract, was this a lease for a term of over a year? It was a question of was it for more than a year? And it was for over a year because he continued living there for 8 years and he's still alive to this day.
Then he was a tenant at will.
Correct.
And then she could terminate the tenancy at any time.
That we would divert to, yeah, we would go to landlord-tenant law for that. That is correct.
So he's still out.
But not out as personal property. Or what if she breached the lease in terminating it, if there was a breach of the lease at that point, he would be entitled to those damages.
All right, thank you, Mr. Ogle. Mr. Brinkley.
May it please the court, Mr. Ogle. Where I see the biggest issue is what is the property? You had years of Mr. Clifford out there, 8 years, it seems to be the approximate timeline where he had property out there, Ms. Greason had property out there, property they accumulated during marriage. The list he offered had items on it, but he never went into any kind of specificity about what those items were. He didn't show any pictures. We did take that trip out there to review what was out there for the purpose of determining what was still out there to submit another list. And that list, as Mr. Clifford answered when we were conducting the trial, that he didn't have a list of what was out there. He didn't make a separate list after our trip out there. So I do think he has to show what kind of property is out there, what kind of personal effects are out there.
Why does he have to show that it was maintained by Ms. McCall Grusin after it was converted? What case says that he has to show that it was retained after it was converted?
You know, I don't have a case off the top of my head on that, but it would seem that he would have to show, you know, if he can't just ask for the moon, he has to say, I have a lawnmower out there, I have clothes. I'm just throwing out examples.
I'm looking at the list, and it says mineral collection, television and VCR player, two custom-made lamps. I mean, that looks pretty specific.
But he also didn't go into any kind of, you know, this is mine, or, you know, he didn't go into any kind of detail about what he had out there. He didn't follow up and said, this is missing, or this remains, I want it back, or this is missing, and I think it's worth $100 and after normal wear and tear.
That's exactly like what he did. He has a property at hand around the house, and then he has a three-page list, actually longer than that, 11-page list.
But he also just never went into that, this is what I'm asking for. He never crossed that burden or that threshold, I guess you could say, of saying this is what I want back. Even if he did have that list, even if that list was properly admitted or a part of the record, he never asked it, I want this back specifically. He just kind of said, I want my things without saying what my things are. And that's why we don't believe he met every element of his conversion claim.
I have a question,
sure.
A follow-up question. Now, the list was made and submitted to the court, and then there was another trip out to the real property?
Yes, we were set for trial, and I don't have the dates, but we were set for trial one morning. He did file a motion wanting to view the property, and I don't know what the reasoning was. Maybe the judge was sick. There was one time where Judge Morris was sick, and we agreed to take that trip out to the property for what I believe the purpose of determining what was still there in hopes of either – hopefully settling the matter or narrowing the issues to what would remain. He never submitted a follow-up list of what was there or not.
So is it your position that he's only entitled to get conversion damages for what she retained?
I believe that we're not clear on what's there. I mean, he submitted a list, but he never followed through.
Why
does
that matter? Doesn't it matter what was taken or what was not returned?
I understand.
Following you on why what was retained is relevant to establishing a conversion claim.
But he has to show what the property is. I mean, he did submit the list, but he never followed through and said, you know, this is mine or this. He just submitted a list that could have been anything without any kind of proof it was actually out there and converted by Ms. Greason.
So when it says list of personal property belonging to Richard Clifford that I was not allowed to remove by Sherry Greason, that doesn't say that that's what he wants back?
Well, I think he never really got specific enough as to what he wanted back. That's my contention. I understand your question. As far as the election of remedies, I don't believe that was timely. He didn't, you know, make his election timely. He had that option, but, you know, he never really showed. It goes back to what was there. He never elected, I want my things back. I want this item back, or I want these specific lists back. He just said my property. He didn't refer to the list in the exhibit or, you know, X, Y, and Z items. So he wasn't specific enough in his electing his remedy of wanting his property back.
Tell me about the 7 days that he was given to get his property out and his claim that he was prevented from removing his property during the 7 days.
There was a default judgment. There was an eviction from the JP court and to the county court at law. Following that default judgment where Mr. Clifford did not show up, he was given 7 days to retrieve his property. And I believe my office did the writ of execution on that, and he had the 7 days. As far as I know, he never made any real effort. He testified that he tried to call Ms. Greason, but he never showed that he made any kind of real effort other than those alleged phone calls. So I think he had his 7 days where he could have went up there and got it out and removed the property or removed as much as he could have. So I think he had his timeline to remove that property before the conversion suit was filed.
Okay, so did he ask for an extension of time?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, he did not approach my office about that. Now, I can't say if he asked Ms. Greason about that, but I'm not aware of any extension of time or anything. And I think Mr. Ogle's right. Some of the timelines about the surgeries and everything, I'm not sure where that falls into, whether it was after the default judgment he was asking for the property back or if that was another time. This has been an ongoing saga for almost a decade. And so I don't know what point where all that fits in, but as far as I know, he had his 7 days, and he just did not follow through and remove those items.
So his first action that you're aware of was a lawsuit for conversion?
That's what I'm aware of. That's when Ms. Greason came back to me and said, hey, I've been sued for conversion, and then we went from there. So I don't know of any reason why he did not have his 7 days. And as far as the damages issue, he never offered any kind of testimony. As you know, he had the list, and maybe he said that it was worth item whatever, it might be worth $100, but he didn't show any receipts or anything to establish the value. That was his own estimation. He didn't factor anything for wear and tear or what the market value might be of those items out there. So to establish any kind of claim for damages, he would have to show what his basis of his claims for what that item was worth. And he never did that. He never put on any kind of evidence of, well, you know, item, you know, if his lawnmower is worth $300 and now it's worth $250 after wear and tear. He never put on anything to show what he paid for it, what the market value might be. And so I think that his claim for conversion damages falls short. And there's, you know, case law that the purchase price and the market, the manner and the time and place of use, the appearance before the alleged injury, all those are factors to establish conversion damages, and he never offered anything other than just what he said it was worth. And that's some evidence, but it's not enough to get to any kind of, you know, a claim for conversion damages. So without any kind of fair market value or any kind of purchase price or anything like that, I don't see how we can get to a claim for damages for Mr. Clifford on his property. You know, at best he might be able to elect for it to be returned, but for any kind of damages. He never showed any kind of conclusive value for what those were worth. And as far as the manner in which the trial court conducted the trial, I have to admit it was a little unorthodox, but we were dealing with a pro se litigant. He got off task several times. He went into things from the divorce. He went into things for improvements on the property that were outside the scope of the suit. I think anything Judge Morris did in the trial was more to narrow him to what the issues were. I don't think Judge Morris was trying to conduct an unfair trial by any means. I think he was just trying to push Mr. Clifford to where he needed to be and keep him on task on what the issues were, conversion and the claim for the oral lease, and then not delve off into these side topics of improvements to the property and to the money owed out of the divorce and any kind of divorce issues. So I think that anything that Judge Morris did, he tried to narrow his focus in on what was there. Judge Morris did ask questions. I think that goes back to he was just trying to clarify and find out what the real issues were, especially what property was there. He asked several times, what's there? What do you have? Can you tell me what you got there? I believe the judge was just trying to help things along, clarify the issues. I don't think he was trying to conduct the trial in any manner that was unfair to Mr. Clifford. I just believe he was trying to narrow the focus. And as far as the discovery issue, Mr. Clifford announced ready. I mean, you can't get any more clear than that. The morning of announcement, I'm ready for trial. Not, as Judge Morris pointed out, Judge, I'm ready if they give me more discovery. It was, I'm ready for trial. He showed up the morning of, and he wanted to push his issue on the motion to compel, but he has to exercise some due diligence on this. If he would have, you know, pushed it at a trial announcement or set it for the motion for a hearing, then we might have something. But he just waited till the last minute and said, Judge, I need more evidence. I need something from them. He didn't pursue it with any kind of due diligence.
Are you saying he never set his discovery motion for hearing?
I never saw any kind of a notice of setting. I've got the filing on it, and it was never set. He never followed up, and it goes back to exercising due diligence. If he really wanted that discovery, he would have worked with the court to set that for a hearing or raise the issue of announcement.
So he filed a motion for discovery, didn't set it for hearing, then filed a motion to compel?
Well, he didn't set his motion to compel for a hearing. I'm sorry.
Okay.
And he
set the motion for discovery for a hearing.
Not that I may have been unclear about that. It was a motion to compel, I'm sorry, that he did not set for a hearing. He waited till the last minute, the morning of trial, to raise that issue. He didn't raise it at an announcement. He didn't ask for a separate hearing. He didn't do anything. So, in other words, he didn't exercise due diligence on pursuing his discovery request or any kind of discovery request he made. And I think he's got to exercise that due diligence to be able to fall back on that claim. And without that, I mean, waiting to the morning of trial isn't exercising due diligence. And as far as the oral lease, I think we covered that. But, you know, the plain meaning of the question that I thought I asked was it for a length of time more than 1 year on the oral lease? But I think the point was also raised that it's also basic landlord-tenant law. She had a tenancy at will. She terminated that. And I think that issue is moot at this time before the court. And unless there's any other questions, I'll rest.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brinkley. Mr. Ogle, rebuttal.
Just briefly respond to a couple of the points raised. I think that on the first question he asked about what is the property, no detail of its mind, that there was property accumulated during the marriage. All of these are things that are not in the record. The only thing that's in the record is Mr. Clifford's list of what he contends was his personal property, and as Justice Walker read on page 23 of the clerk's record, that he was not allowed to remove. That's the only evidence of what's in the house. There's no other evidence of what was allegedly accumulated or what was hers, either in this list or otherwise. So if Ms. McCall Grusin believed that there needed to be further detail than a 11-page list, there certainly was an opportunity for cross-examination on all of these specific items. On the election of the remedy, counsel says that it was untimely made. The case law says that you just have to make your election a remedy before judgment is rendered. The judgment was March the 4th. The trial was February 22nd. So on page 43 of the third volume of the reporter's record, when he says, "Can I not retrieve my things?" it should have been obvious to everyone at the trial that the things he's referring to are the things in this list. And so he is asking to retrieve his things, which are the ones that he says he was not allowed to return.
The trial was February 22nd.
2013. There is an error in the judgment that says the trial was February 22nd, 2012.
Okay.
But it was 2013. And so I think he did elect his remedy, if that's what he was, if you consider that question an election of his remedy. He made it before the judgment. But even if he didn't elect his remedy, the trial court is supposed to award the maximum recovery under the law to Mr. Clifford. And it did not do that here. So that then falls upon this court. And what Mr. Clifford is asking of this court is to make, to render judgment that the trial court should have rendered, which would be the return of the property that is still there and damages for the things that are gone. On damages, the case law that my opponent has cited, there are a number of factors when you start getting into actual value about receipts and different types of proof. We don't have any of that here. There were no questions. What essentially is happening is Mr. Clifford put on his own assessment, which an owner of personal property has the right to do, and that can be and is competent evidence. And so the only real issue for this court is it conclusive or is it just some evidence, and there needs to be we've got a question of factual insufficiency to go back and figure out that the zero finding on damages is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. If Ms. McCall-Grusin wanted to challenge the purchase price and all the other details, that was certainly available during cross-examination or through the direct testimony of Ms. McCall-Grusin had she chosen to take the stand. On the discovery issue, I would just simply point out that I'll just correct the timeline just briefly. The letter for this information was sent December 6, 2012. The motion is filed February the 13th. It's denied on February 15th, and trial is on the 22nd. So I don't think that there's any case law that says when you announce ready that somehow waives your complaint about your denied motion to compel. But there's really no – this due diligence only comes into – that element only comes into play when we're dealing with a motion for continuance, which Mr. Clifford was not required to file. He was diligent. He did get a ruling denying his motion to compel. So to the extent that this court reaches this discovery issue, it was properly preserved, and this court can address it.
Okay, Keith, let me ask you this question. If his list was supposed to be a list of property he was claiming, and her reaction is, or he says, "Give me a list of all the property that is mine that is in your house." Because there's no question it's her house.
Correct.
And her attitude is, "Nothing in that house belongs to you. It is all mine." How does the trial judge know from, does the trial judge then have to go back and relitigate the divorce property settlement? Does the trial judge have to go relitigate the eviction and the order to consider the property abandoned? I mean, how much is this trial judge going to have to, how many times does all this have to be relitigated? He said, "Tell me what property is mine." She says, "Nothing's yours. Send me a list of everything that's mine." She sends no list. Okay, she's answered. She's provided him a list of everything she considers his. I mean, how many times does this get litigated?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is, I think that part of the problem is that post-divorce, there's this oral agreement that she lets him continue living at the property. And so, to the extent that there
were... Excuse me a minute. Can I ask the people in the audience to please not gesture or visit? It's rather distracting. We're trying to listen to the comments. Thank you.
I mean, the evidence in the record, I mean, there is apparently a family saga that's gone on that is beyond what Mr. Brinkley or I really can attest to in this record, and I only know what's in the record. And so the fact that in the record Mr. Clifford says she allowed me to live on the property with my things, and there's these two conditions, I don't know exactly what was divvied up in the divorce, but I don't think you're relitigating what's divvied up. You're just litigating now that you're in not a husband-wife relationship, you're in a landlord-tenant relationship, and that ends, as you said, under a tenancy at will, it ends when she says leave and evicts him. Then the question is, well, what is the property that he's entitled to take with him? If she thought that none was his and this was all hers, or that some was hers, she could have taken the stand and put on evidence. But under this court's review, you look at the record, and for any evidence to support the no finding on the issue of what property is there, and there is no evidence to support the trial court's finding that this is somehow all her property or partially her property. The only evidence in the record about whose property is this list. So, you know, if this were to go back,
and his testimony that does not provide very much guidance to that trial judge.
Well, it is complicated, because if you look at each item as a separate act of conversion, and you're going to go back, and let's say that there was another trial, he would take the stand, she would take the stand, and the judge is then left in the position of determining a fact question about what is his, what is hers, and
mineral
making
collection
that determination.
Partial. A television. A VCR player. Clothing. You gonna go pick it up? You gonna know what to pick up? That's the record we've got.
I understand. And if this court determines that it's not legally, that it's not conclusive, then it's our position that the no finding is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence, and we can go back and Mr. Clifford can take pictures, and if he needs to get model and serial numbers and three red shirts, three blue shirts, I guess that would be the result.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ogle. Mr. Brinkley, we appreciate all of your arguments today and all of your excellent briefing in this case. Your case is now submitted, so you all are excused, and we will ask the clerk to now adjourn us. Thank you.